Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagram Aradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is retired United States Army Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the former commander of U.S. Army forces in Europe, who is now the Pershing Chair at the Center for European Policy Analysis, based in sunny Frankfurt, Germany. He is also the author of a worthwhile new report, Black Sea or Black Hole. Ben, it's always great to have you back on. It's been too long. Thanks so much for joining us.
Margo, thank you for the opportunity and privilege.
It's really a treat. I miss our regular conversations when you were in uniform, and it certainly is great to have you back on and want to have you back on a more regular basis. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Sir, great report. And it really puts a focus on a very critical part of the world that we tend not to pay as much attention to, right? I mean, everybody pays attention to these sort of frontier areas between autocracy and democracy, right? Everybody pays a lot of attention to the Baltic, but not so much to the Black Sea, where the Russians are incredibly active. And in fact, is a real nexus of great power competition, because obviously you've got Turkey right there on the border as well. We have a new administration coming into office in Washington. We have an EU that is looking at becoming somewhat rejuvenated in a post-Brexit world to put its mark on things. And obviously we have a NATO leadership that is becoming increasingly focused on the region. From your standpoint, after studying and having served in this region for a long time, what are the key takeaways from your standpoint?
Well, the key takeaway, number one, is that the Black Sea is the cauldron of competition between East and West. This is the frontier, if you will, between liberal democracies and autocracies, not just with the Kremlin, but also with continuing and increasing Chinese investment and encroachment. So the problem is that the Black Sea has always kind of been off in the corner, and we didn't appreciate the strategic importance of it. And that's why we end up now with Russian troops sitting in Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. The criticality of the South Caucasus. Unless you like really, really focus and specifically worked on that, people did not appreciate the strategic importance of it. It's the only east-west corridor between Eurasia and Europe that doesn't go through Russia or Iran. And so, which is not a surprise why the Russians took the opportunity to get their so-called peacekeepers into Nagorno-Karabakh. Now, if you could get people to invest, Americans and Western European countries to invest in the region, then they have skin in the game. Then they start paying attention to, hey, why are the Russians still sitting in Crimea, in Donbass, in Transnistria, and still occupying 20% of Georgia? But because we haven't had much investment there, there hasn't been much incentive to push back on what the Russians are doing. For the Russians, I had a Romanian intelligence officer tell me one time, he said, think of the Black Sea as a balcony for the Kremlin that enables them to look out over Syria, the Middle East, the Aegean, the Caucasus, and the Balkans. It's essential for them to continue to be aggressive against those countries. This is why we have to compete there.
You know, I forgot to mention in my introduction that the Bulgarian ambassador to the United States made a great point, right? What happens in the Black Sea doesn't stay in the Black Sea, which I think is terrific. And we've seen extraordinary Russian meddling, right, in Montenegro in terms of, you know, whether it was attempted coups or disinformation campaigns and bikers causing trouble. One of the things, Ben, you write is that Romania is really a center of gravity. And it's a country that's been looking at building up its military capabilities, hosting American forces. What are the capability investments and the approach and the strategy needed by the nations themselves, but also regionally, right? How does the United States, NATO, and allies and partners help these countries build up those capabilities, whether they're on the information, misinformation, disinformation side, all the way up to the hard power side of the equation?
Well, Vago, thanks for that, for reminding me of the quote by the ambassador. He's right. I mean, it's the Black Sea and then the Turkish Straits is what enables Russia to get out into Syria. And remember, it was Russian support that kept the Assad regime in power, the same regime that used chemical weapons against its own people and put about 4 million refugees on the road into Turkey and into Europe, what General Breedlove once called the weaponization of immigrants. That was not an accident. That was intended collateral outcome by the Kremlin because of the destabilizing effect it had on Turkey and on Europe. Of course, it's without their position in Crimea and their numerical advantage in the Black Sea, partly as a result of Montreux Convention restrictions. They're able to go out into the Med. Of course, you know, they're trying to establish a base in Libya as well as in East Africa. All of this is made possible because they we have not competed adequately in the Black Sea region. Now, it is important to talk about the Black Sea region, in fact, the greater Black Sea region, not just the Black Sea. Romania, a terrific ally. I remember when I was in Afghanistan, when President Obama increased the number of troops in Afghanistan back in 2009, only two other allies also increased, the UK and Romania. They are a very good ally. And I think that they're the center of gravity for the alliance because of where they sit, number one, geographically. They're on the Black Sea, but their back is protected, if you will, by other allied nations. And their big port of Constanta offers not only economic benefit, but military benefit as an important port. It's why we have a logistics hub at a place called MK, which is the Mikhail Kogalnachanu Romanian Air Base and International Airport. We've had a log base there for several years. There's over 1,000 US troops there now. Our Air Force just recently deployed MQ-9 Reaper element to Câmpia Turzi there in Romania. So a lot of good things going on. Plus Romania is undertaking a serious modernization effort. But of course, they can't do this alone. And Minister Ciuca, who used to be the Chief of Defense, he's now Minister of Defense, I think was very smart to establish a closer relationship with Ukraine, with the Ukrainian Minister of Defense. So training, information sharing, cooperation. This is the model that needs to happen all around the Black Sea. Frankly, Turkey should be the center of gravity on the Black Sea as a significant and very important NATO ally. But Turkey, let's just say it's the relationship between Turkey and the United States right now is not as good as it should be between Turkey and Europe and inside the alliance. Of course, there are challenges. I do think it's time for a Turkey-USA 2.0. We have to rebuild trust because when you look at that map, it's obvious why Turkey is so important to everybody that's concerned. But of course, they have issues to their south, east, and west. I once had a conversation with the J5 of the Turkish General Staff. I said, "General, how's it going?" He said, "Ben, every morning I wake up, I've got Russia to the north, Iran, Iraq, Syria to the south, the Caucasus to the east, and the Balkans to the west. It's a hell of a neighborhood." And he's right. And most of us don't think about Turkey and those in that way. I mean, you know, the boundary between UCOM and CENTCOM is the border between Turkey and Syria. And that causes us to think and act in ways that are the opposite of what would be most helpful with our longtime Turkish ally. The Balkans, you have to think of the Balkans from Greece all the way up through Serbia as part of the greater Black Sea region. Because number one, the Danube River runs through Serbia, but also this is the back door into Romania and Bulgaria. And so we need a strategy, both in the alliance and in Washington, that makes sure we're competing in terms of diplomacy, information, and economy, not just military, in order to help counter what Russia is doing there.
So give us a sense of what Russia is doing there. right? What are some of the things Russia is doing that go beyond disinformation? Because there's this sense that the Russians will not engage directly with NATO, right? That Putin, for example, moved into Ukraine because it was a gray space, an ill-defined space. On the other hand, others are not as confident. And now, right in 2014, when you were U.S. Army Europe commander, when Russia went into Ukraine, Putin had demonstrations at home, which was one of the reasons why he acted. Now he's got more demonstrations in more places that potentially suggests he may act out internationally. So give us the sort of yin and yang, like what are some of the things the Russians are doing now? What do we have to be guarded of about what Russia might yet do, especially as Putin comes under more pressure?
Well, first of all, let me challenge the premise of your question. Ukraine is not ill-defined space. It's a sovereign country, and Russia invaded it.
I didn't mean it from that standpoint. Completely agree. I'm just saying that it wasn't a NATO country, so he felt like he had a latitude to act against a sovereign country, because he could do so, right?
Okay. I'll take that. I think he invaded Ukraine because he saw that we did not do anything in Syria. I mean, the president at the time, President Obama, without a red line and told Assad, do not use chemical weapons. They did. We did nothing. The UK did nothing. France did nothing. We all backed down. And I think that emboldened the president of the Russian Federation. He was pretty confident. And unfortunately, it turned out he was right that the West would not really react if he went into Ukraine and seized Crimea. And there are still senior people in leadership positions in Europe that are willing to look the other way. I mean, I've even heard them say, well, you know, Crimea used to be Russia. This is a complete false narrative. And right. So I think that the West has got to enforce international law. We have got to stick together. The United States has got to show leadership here, and we have to show sustained interest, not on a kind of a curve, you know, or when it's convenient. We have to, no kidding, compete. And I do believe, by the way, that great power competition prevents great power conflict. It's when you fail to show interest, when you fail to compete somewhere, that tells the other side, okay, they're not going to do anything. And that's exactly what has happened over the last 20 plus years in the Black Sea region. Now, three Ukrainian soldiers were killed last week. And this is during the so-called ceasefire. And I think it is embarrassing and pathetic that Germany and France have not done more to hold the Kremlin accountable for its actions, and to not hold the Kremlin accountable for living up to international agreements. We need to do everything possible to demonstrate that nobody is willing to accept Russian sovereignty over Crimea. I'm encouraged that the U.S. Congress, there's a bill just put forth by Congressman Connolly, that says that no U.S. government entity, agency, or part of the government can do anything that in any way conveys that Russia has sovereignty over Crimea. It's a tiny little example, but I mean, Twitter. Twitter gives on Twitter, the little blue check mark, which a certification blue check mark, for the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Crimea. That right there is an example of Twitter acknowledging, okay, this is legitimate. Well, of course it's not legitimate. Or when Google Maps colors the Donbass or Crimea as if it's part of Russia. These are minor things, but they matter. On a much higher level, I think we should, all of us should be holding or saying that any vessel that sails out of any port in Crimea, any vessel that sails out of any port in Crimea is contraband, because President Poroshenko, when he was the president of Ukraine, declared all those ports closed, and yet the Russians continue to operate those ports. Therefore, technically, every one of those vessels is operating illegally, so they should not be allowed to enter any other port. But this would take strong, hard diplomatic work, and to be candid, the United States failed to do that over the last few years. I hope that the new administration will back up what President Biden said in his first phone call with President Putin, that Ukrainian sovereignty is a priority. That was in the very first phone call. He included that. I'm hoping that the administration will back that up with action. But people should remember, Ukrainian soldiers are still getting killed in Donbass by Russians. It isn't, these are not some sort of, you know, it's not some civil war. These are some rebels out there. This is Russian-led, Russian-commanded, Russian-supplied, and there are Russian troops out there. There's no way in the world that the type of equipment and ammunition and stuff that's being done there in Donbass could be done by a bunch of farmers. This is Russia prevents the OSCE from doing its job to monitor, and that's what's going on here. And they're happy with it. They're getting exactly what they want.
Do you think that Russia will act out regionally in a more dramatic fashion? I mean, do we need to be on our guard as we weren't in 2014, as Putin comes under greater pressure?
Well, again, I think, honestly, Germany is the only country that can influence Kremlin behavior. So far, as we saw the other day, when Minister Lavrov just humiliated Mr. Borrell, it shows that they have zero respect for the European Union so far. But right. I think that they respect Germany. And I think that they will, if Germany decides that the attempted poisoning of Mr. Navalny, the murder of Mr. Nemtsov, murder of a Russian opponent in the Tiergarten in Berlin, hacking of the Bundestag by the Kremlin, and on and on and on and on. At some point, Germany has to say, okay, this is not going to get any better. You can't separate business from diplomacy. And for Germany to retain what it has earned over the last 70 years, a lot of moral authority, to retain that moral authority, they have got to hold the Kremlin accountable. And but that means they need to know that the United States is with them. And so I think the administration will work closely with Berlin. I hope so, to hold the Kremlin accountable, because we're going to have to do the same thing, work closely with Germany when it comes to dealing with the Chinese Communist Party as well.
Right. When you look at regional right. So you said that there needs to be a broader right. Everybody talks about the economic, diplomatic right. I mean, I don't even want to get into Nord Stream. I mean, I think that's a mistake for Germany and certainly something that can be used as leverage. That's not really been used as much. Right. I mean, in terms of German power over Russia, what does an integrated regional strategy look like, Ben? Right, that gets into the details of some of the capabilities that we need to have on that southern flank. Because as you said, I mean, you gave like a master course in geography. And oftentimes people don't look at maps, right? And when you look at the map, you begin to realize, wow, this is a really important part of the world. What are some of the details in terms of what that strategy, what this new administration needs to do to continue deterring and shaping and engaging and building allied and partnered capabilities?
Well, step one, the president has already done it, as has Secretary Austin, has made it clear that the United States is committed to NATO and that we're committed to Europe. So that was very important to eliminate any doubt, any, you know, puzzlement about, you know, can we count on the United States? So that was very important to be doing. I think that, secondly, there's a recognition that China is, of course, the Chinese Communist Party, I should say, is the long-term strategic threat, and that the United States is going to increasingly have to focus there. But in order to do that, we have to be working closely with our European allies and Canada, as well as our allies in the Pacific, because we need this strong European pillar, not a European pillow, that can continue to deter the Kremlin, that can continue to hold the Chinese Communist Party accountable for human rights violations and technology theft and so on, while the U.S. has to shift more and more of its attention into the Indo-Pacific region. So that means we have to shore up what we have. And I really believe, if you think of kind of a three-legged stool, if you will, of American diplomacy and American military / security cooperation. The third leg of the stool for the United States is private investment. If we can figure out how to get more and more companies investing into Central and Eastern Europe, especially, and these are the areas, by the way, that are growing faster. Western Europe is not growing. Central and Eastern Europe is growing.
Right.
And so if we could invest more there and get more skin in the game, if you will, not only does that help the American worker, it also improves quality of life and therefore societal resilience in those countries and makes them less vulnerable. They're not as reliant on Russian gas, for example. They're not as vulnerable to Russian disinformation. They're not as vulnerable to disinformation and corruption. So these are the things I think that we have to do. And of course, the United States has got to, we've got to live up to our own talking points. And honestly, we haven't done that. And January 6th certainly is not our best day. But what happened after January 6th is a good example and a good story to tell that I think that we do have to tell.
You know what? It's interesting. You mentioned that. So let me ask you about the information, disinformation, and authoritarian tension. Right? The report, and in it, you write that we actually, as the West, have a good narrative. But one of the things that Russia is always trying to do is to undermine the notion of democracy. That its way of government is just as good, and in fact, better. Right. And authoritarianism, it has been unfortunately on the rise. Right. Poland and Hungary tilting toward a more somewhat more of a authoritarian model. There's, you know, the right extremist movements that European governments. Right. I mean, the Germany is now coming to terms that, for example, the police and elements of the military had a much stronger right wing element than anybody thought. Right. And that's a little bit of a concern in the United States that does. Is the military or, you know, or law enforcement producing people that go into militias, for example? Netherlands has Italy, France are all countries that have strong right-wing elements. And then, of course, we had January 6th. How do democracies need, Ben, to show and to live up to democracies, right? The House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith once said, you know, the way to counter all of these countries around the world is for democracies to act like democracies and show that democracy is the best model. How do you think we do this? How do European governments have to address this, given that, you know, our last president for many right of center movements seemed to be an inspiration?
Well, so let's put a little historical context on it here. The United States, we declared our independence in 1776. We had a constitution since the 1780s. So we've been at this now for over 230 years, and it's still not perfect. But, I mean, we've been doing the hard work and to protect this democracy, and we've been through a terrible civil war where almost 700,000 people were killed. We still are dealing with the aftershocks of slavery and all the other social issues that are out there. But yet, still, every 2 years, we reelect or we have an election for every member of the House of Representatives and one third of our senators. Every 4 years, we do a presidential election. And while January the 6th was an awful day, and like most people, I was watching impeachment trial, and it's just gut-wrenching to see what's happening. The fact is that whatever that was, and no doubt it was incited by our president at the time, failed. And the Congress came back into their chambers that same night and continued doing their constitutional duty, certified the Electoral College process, and President Biden, or Joseph Biden and Kamala Harris were elected president and vice president. To me, this is a great story that we need to tell. The focus, understandably, right now is on the terrible, the riot, the insurrection, and the near disaster that almost happened on January 6th. And unfortunately, five people, in fact, lost their lives. But the good news is that same night, you know, the election was certified. Right. And the courts have rejected every one of the bogus attempts to claim that in some state somewhere that the election had been stolen or not correctly done.
Right.
And then within a week, the president was impeached. I mean, I challenge any big business to move that fast. And so our democratic process has worked. January the 20th was a day for millions and millions of people, not only in the United States, but around the world. It's like, it was a positive thing. Now, again, I don't want to oversell this or make it seem like everything's perfect, but because it's not. But people, I can tell you that here in Europe, people expect us. They have really, really high expectations. And even the countries that criticize us the most, and there's a lot of them, they still have high expectations for the United States. There's a reason millions of people try to get to the United States, or they send their kids to the States for school, because they know for young people, this is the best place on the planet for opportunity. That's what I mean by telling a better story. And the last thing the Russians want, the last thing the Kremlin wants is for Russians to look over and see how much better life is in Poland, in Lithuania, in Latvia, in Estonia, and even in Georgia, how much better life is there than it was when they were part of the Soviet Union or part of the Warsaw Pact or somehow under their influence. That's the last thing they want. And those Ukrainians, what an incredible group of people. They saw how much better life is in Poland, and they said, we want that. And that's how you end up with Maidan.
Let me ask you two quick questions before we wrap up. Every American administration for decades has been urging Europe to do more. I think people forget how tough the Obama administration was in terms of delivering that message. And Joe Biden went to the Verkunda conference and delivered the message. You guys got to step up and you got to do more for your security. Donald Trump scared countries into doing that. Whether it was scared or to curry favor, however you want to put it, they're spending more. Is Europe making the progress it needs to be making in terms of improving its military capabilities, especially given that the United States is going to have to focus more of its limited resources in Asia?
Yeah, I would say in some ways, yes. But look, this improvement was already starting before President Trump started threatening. Now, for sure, he was correct to put pressure on our allies, especially countries like Germany. But the problem is the approach that he took damaged the cohesion of the alliance. And at the end of the day, it's the cohesion of NATO that is the best guarantee of deterrence more than anything. I'm not against 2%. It's an important metric, but these are not club dues. And the way the right. president characterized it, to be honest, here in Germany, it had the opposite effect. And so I think what I would expect from the new administration is really, really strong pressure on Germany to do more. But we can be a lot more sophisticated about, you know, what constitutes 2%. And Germany, I predict, is going to step up more. They have to. For sure they have to. If they don't, then the alliance, you know, we do have a crack in the cohesion, which we don't want. But I predict the next 10 presidents will all be talking about why don't allies do more. But I have to say, all of our best and most reliable allies in the world come from Europe, as well as Canada and Australia. And even if none of them spent one penny, the fact that we're able to have Ramstein and Landstuhl and headquarters in Stuttgart and Wiesbaden and training in Grafenwehr and Vilsack and the air base in Spangdahlem, this is to our advantage. It helps us, it helps NATO. And frankly, the EU is the biggest trading partner for the United States. And as long as Europe is stable and secure and prosperous, it's good for the American worker as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that's where there's a lot of wisdom in the administration's strategy to bring all of its democratic allies and partners together to draft a concerted China strategy, especially given that now China is Europe's number one trading partner, right?
Well, look, we're definitely going to work together when it comes to China. One thing I meant to challenge earlier, I would not put Poland in the same category as Hungary. There are issues, but they've been a democracy for 30 years. And they are such an important ally, and they have done so much. I think that it would be a terrible shame if Poland was somehow left out of this democracy, right. Summit of democracy. That would be an absolute huge mistake.
Let me ask you one last question in about 30 seconds. Turkey. How does the new administration need to engage with an autocrat who is going back into fence straddling mode? And I have to tell you, I was in Brussels when we could travel, but I've certainly talked to friends over there. And there's a lot of concern about whether Turkey should even remain part of NATO.
Yeah, I tell you what, it would be a disaster if we lost Turkey. We are, no matter how challenging, the alliance is so much better with Turkey. Look at the map. Strategy cannot be based on emotion. Administrations change. Geography does not change. We need Turkey in the alliance, and Turkey needs us. And I think President Erdogan knows that. But they have no confidence that the West is with them. I mean, you know, we need to put the Black Sea and Turkey in the middle of the map, and it'll change how we think about the region. You can't have a Turkey strategy until you have a Black Sea strategy. And we've got to do what it takes to reestablish trust. I'm not excusing any of the terrible decisions that Ankara has made. For example, the S-400 thing, but it would be better for us if we found a golden bridge for them to walk across so we can get out of this mess that they have created.
Sir, it's always a pleasure having you on and talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us and spending so much time with us. I know you've got crazy days, and I'm talking to you at night. It's a reasonable hour here. It's later, and I know you got multiple events. I just want to say thank you again, and you're welcome aboard anytime. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate the privilege.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.